You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 6, today we're in Longwy.
Michael, mate, how was that day?
Yeah, it's probably been one of the hardest Tour de France stages I ever done myself.
That's really a big call. It is
a big call because, like, you know, obviously mountain days are hard, but this was not a mountain day. This was a more flat stage, but it was like, I think we had 50 k's an hour, and I never seen anything like that. The yellow jersey jumping around in front, going for a breakaway. I don't know if anybody told Van Aert if he think the race finished Sunday.
That's exactly what I said. I said his engine's running hot. I'm like, where can it go from here? Every single day he's been doing sprints, obviously 2 days ago. Today,
I see myself, so many guys is just fighting to stay in the bunch, you know. And you see the leader of the race jumping like that in front of to catch the breakaway is truly impressive. I think also many guys was in doubt if we would ever catch him today.
What do you think that was all about? Because I'm still trying to work it out.
I think he's just an extremely talented and strong rider, and he probably have a little bit hard time to hold back. Apparently he doesn't feel his legs.
That was Mikkel Mørkøe of Quickstep, the Danish rider, of course, and he has ridden 119 Tour de France stages, and he rates that as one of the hardest. It was certainly fast, 49.4 kilometres an hour average, well over 200 kilometres, lumpy, third and fourth category climbs on the route. We saw the yellow jersey off the front all day, more or less, first in a group of about five, then in a group of three, then two, and then finally solo until 11 kilometres to go. We'll discuss what on earth Wout van Aert was doing up the road. But first of all, François, where are we?
Well, we are in Longwy. We're actually just outside of Longwy, in the suburbs, I should say. As we know from previous stages in Longwy, and you know, no insult to the Longwy people, it's an area where it's not very easy to find a decent place to have dinner. I managed to find, by chance, a place that's not far from a hotel, a little bit outside of everything. We kind of walked through a field and around warehouses to get here. But it's a nice place. It looks very promising.
It's called Oxalis, and we've sat down, and we have a lovely podcasting beer. I'm particularly happy about this. But Mitch, you must be even happier because we are drinking your favourite beer, your number one beer in the world.
Well, we're actually in Orval country. And if anyone knows me or anyone knows my podcast, Life in the Peloton, they'll know I'm spruiking about this beer all the time because it is amazing, this beer. It is one of the seven Trappists from Belgium. And the Trappist beers, if anyone doesn't know out there, it's a Belgian beer that was brewed by the monks back in the day. And to remain an actual Trappist beer, the beers still have to be produced in the original abbeys by the monks. I don't know if that is still the case. It's a bit loose on that side of things. But Orval is one of the beers that have a limit to the amount of beers that they produce every year. Not to the extent of the Westvleteren, which is one of the most famous. But they don't just mass produce. They have their limit, and it can be quite sought out because Orval is one of the only beers that can actually age and go up in price after the years. It's like a wine. So if you can find a beer, an Orval, that is, you know, 2 years older, it gets doubles in price, triples in price, and goes from there. The thing that happens with an Orval, the flavour changes, but it loses its gas as well as it gets older. But that can become desirable for some people. It's very much like a wine, and when it's young, it's a bit more sharp, a bit more, you know, fresh. As it ages, it gets deeper and the flavours are much stronger. Not desirable for some people. For me, I like it both ways. And I have aged some, and I've got two bottles left from 2014. I snuck them in my case, took them back to Australia. I'm waiting for a special night for those two.
Well, tonight we're staying in a B&B Hotels hotel, aren't we? I was half expecting Pierre Rolland to be on reception checking us in or something, but no, much disappointed that the riders don't have to do a shift in the local B&B hotel tour stage.
He was there.
Whoa, was he?
Did you not see him?
No,
yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah, it was a picture of him, like, you know, holding a cushion to his cheek. and looking like he's having the sleep of his life.
Well, he probably will need the sleep of his life tonight, won't he? Because stage six was rapid, 49.4 kilometres an hour, well over 200 kilometres from Banche in Belgium to Longwy in France. And, well, we saw the yellow jersey, Wout van Aert, off the front, first of all in a group of five, that then became a group of three with Jakob Fuglsang of Israel Premier Tech and Quinn Simmons of Trek Segafredo. He dropped, to be fair, Fuglsang dropped back after about 65 kilometres to go, presumably realising that he was on a hiding to nothing with van Aert. Simmons hung on a bit longer, but then he was dropped around 30-ish to go, and then van Aert persisted with this move. The yellow jersey off the front. At one point, the time gap was kind of nudging 4 minutes, but he still held it around the minute mark for a long period of the stage towards the end. He had everybody chasing behind. EF were chasing for a long while. Bike Exchange were chasing. But he was caught on that penultimate climb with 11 kilometres to go, where he was finally captured. And then he went out of the back. So he's lost the yellow jersey after all of that work today. There was a crash in the bunch going around the right-hander with 9 kilometres to go, which caused a bit of chaos as well. On the last climb, who was up there? Tish Benoot was up there for Jumbo-Visma. Michael Matthews was going very well at one point. And Alexis Villamoz of Total Energy is putting in a really good attack.
Correction corner. I mean, it's Alexis Villamoz. You don't pronounce either the S or the Z.
Thank you very much. Another correction corner. It was actually the penultimate climb, really, because the final climb to the finish was the final climb. So Villamoz was away. Have I got it wrong again?
Villamoz.
Even more wrong.
Yeah, Alexis Villamoz.
Thank you. You might just have to chip in there each time I mention him, Francois, because it's a tricky one for me, that. He attacked. He was caught. Pogacar was looking really sprightly. And then on that final climb, UAE Team Emirates had Rafał Majka and Brandon McNulty looking very, very strong, leading out Pogacar. And with 500 metres to go, Pogacar in the white jersey, his best young rider, was in second place, looking poised to win the stage, which he did with a fearsome sprint, an incredible acceleration. So he has won the stage and taken the yellow jersey. Michael Matthews was second, just as he was on the same climb at the finish in 2017, that time behind Peter Sagan. You may remember that stage. It was when Sagan pulled his foot in the sprint, got his foot back in, carried on and still had the strength and power to win the stage. A very different Peter Sagan we're seeing this year, and Pogacar is another level beyond even Peter Sagan at his best, even on a kind of punchy little climb like that. So Tom Pidcock, Nairo Quintana, Dylan Teuns and Jonas Vingegaard were the next riders over the line. Geraint Thomas was distant a little bit, lost 5 seconds, as did Alexander Vlasov. But the real disappointment of the day in terms of the GC contenders after his difficult day on the cobbles yesterday, Australia's Ben O'Connor lost 2:37. Wout van Aert, 7:28, as I say, out of yellow. So Pogacar leads Nielsen Paulus by 4 seconds, Vingegaard 31 seconds. We lost another two riders today. Alex Kirsch of Trek Segafredo didn't finish, and Daniel Oss of Total Energies didn't start. Now, we saw Oss on the cobbles the last sector yesterday, didn't we, Mitch? It's reported this morning that he's got a fracture in his neck, and he'd had some kind of mechanical problem or a puncture, hadn't he? And some fans, thinking they were helping him out, tried to push him off, and he really aggressively waved them away. Now we know why.
Also verbally.
Very verbally, yes. Yes. So there we are, stage six, and with La Planche des Belles Filles tomorrow, the question we'll discuss in the next part is, does that mean Tadej Pogacar has got three quarters of the way to winning his third consecutive Tour de France with barely a week's racing done? Before we move on, I must give an update on the vote for the Cycling Podcast MAP jersey. People have been voting at map.cc. You're trying to subvert the vote, Francois, here with some subliminal advertising for Check, your favourite design. Fair enough.
Check.
Keep going. The voting so far, Dot has got 41% of the vote, Check 31% of the vote, and Fade 28% of the vote. Just to annoy Francois, please vote for either Dot or Fade. You can see all the designs at map.cc. And next week, we'll actually hear from the designer to find out a bit about the inspiration behind each of the three designs and what it is about cycling jersey design that particularly appeals to him. His name is Misha Glisevic, and he has been at MAP since the company started.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Listen to the Super Sapiens podcast in your favorite app. You can hear the first couple of episodes, and the first one is with the triathlete Eloise Duluart. And here's a little teaser.
It's all part of my plan. I shouldn't resent anything. I shouldn't resent the fact that I have a call that's ideal swim time. No, you're being paid to do this job. That's part of you being able to do your professional triathlon, and you do enjoy it. And there's always another swim time. Like, don't ever resent what you're very grateful to have and what essentially helps me do me every single day. That in terms of my, I guess, my attitude to working part-time. Don't get me wrong, sometimes I wish I didn't, and I wish I could sit on the sofa all afternoon and just watch Stranger Things. Whatever, that's me. But it's all part of the process.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens for supporting the Cycling Podcast. Now, Mitch, Francois, what can we say about the stage? I mean, let's deal with Tadej Pogačar first, because he looked incredibly impressive on that final climb, didn't he, Mitch?
He did look very impressive. Once again, showing he is looking unbeatable in all aspects of the race. I cannot forget what he was doing yesterday, just one day ago, flat cobblestones, and putting it to one of the best cobblestone riders at the moment, Jasper Stuyven. And today, flip things on their head, and we've got a completely different stage, and he's being showing the best against the sprint, well, the punchers. So it's not even a long climb now. It's another speciality here. Then we've got the long climb tomorrow. No doubt we're expecting something the same.
Well, that's a hammer blow, isn't it, for anyone who is hoping to challenge Pogačar in the mountains, because he's gaining time on the cobbles, and now on the sort of climb that suits the likes of Michael Matthews and, back in the day, Peter Sagan. It's a kind of hybrid climb, isn't it? Not necessarily one for the GC riders, although they can do well and be well-positioned, well-placed, but really shouldn't be in a position to dominate as strongly as well as in the big mountains.
As we said yesterday, I mean, he can do everything except maybe bunch sprints, but we haven't seen him in a bunch sprint position before. I mean, who knows? You mentioned yesterday Vincenzo Nibali. We were discussing the 2014 Tour when they were going to La Planche des Belles Filles. We also had crowds like in Yorkshire, in Denmark. So it's a tour that looks a little bit like the 2014 Tour. And already, Tadej Pogačar looks as dominant as Nibali was that in that tour, which is on all terrains. Like, as you said, yesterday on the cobbles, he didn't win the stage, but he was probably the most impressive rider on the cobbles. Today, you had this kind of finish. We're all asking ourselves this morning, who can win? Sagan is not the rider he used to be. Alaphilippe is not here. Is Tom Pidcock, in the mix? We kind of dared not mention Pogačar, still knowing that probably he would be there at some stage. The thing that gets me the most about Pogačar is you can really tell he enjoys winning, enjoys every kind of effort. Like, he enjoys the time trial, enjoys that kind of punchy finishes. Of course, he enjoys breaking away in the mountains. He's still fresh. He's about to win. Well, he's on his way to winning his third Tour de France, and he's still got his boyish freshness in what he does. And it's really exciting to see, and probably very depressing for his rivals. Mm.
On the plus side, though, there are still a lot of his rivals. Okay, they might be distant rivals when we get through the big mountains, but there still are enough players involved to make this tour interesting. We can't just say, oh, well, that's it. The tour is over after six stages. There's still a long, long way to go. And when you look at the riders stacked up, particularly Ineos Grenadiers, they've done well to get all four of their riders. Okay, So Geraint Thomas lost 5 seconds because of the gaps that opened as they sprinted in, but they're all still there, aren't they? Martinez, Pidcock, Adam Yates, Geraint Thomas, they're looking good. Jumbo-Visma will be encouraged that Primoz Roglic looked good today after his dislocated shoulder. You know, he had a little move on the run-in and was in the mix. Quietly, Romain Bardet and Enric Mas are riding very well and were in that group as well.
Nairo Quintana,
of course. Excellent on the cobbles yesterday and just quietly in there. So it's not done. But the thing about UAE Team Emirates is that they do feel like they've got a team behind Pogacar, which the last couple of years, maybe 2 years ago, couldn't have been said. Last year, the team improved a bit. And then this year, it's improved another kind of couple of levels, hasn't it? Let's hear from Rafał Majka, his Polish teammate, and then Brandon McNulty, the American, because they were crucial in the setup for the stage win.
For sure, we come to win the Tour de France with Tadej, of course. He's the best riders for now in the world. And I'm so happy we win today the stage. Really fast. Today is really fast stage. We come 4 hours something, then yeah, full gas all the time. Actually, so many attacks, so many, you know, and Van Aert is also the front, and yeah, but we keep calm, and some teams help us also. In the end, it's really fast. When it's coming the last 20Ks, we go really fast. All the team, you know, want to go in the front, and Tadej win. That is more important.
Yeah, it wasn't even necessarily the part of the plan, but we were all there into those last few climbs, and yeah, we just went. We had faith in him, so yeah, we just went all in, and yeah, he pulled it off. It was really a fight. You know, it was almost, I think, over an hour and a half, almost just full gas, and then we never really even settled down. It was back to pacing instantly, so yeah, it was a really tough day.
Mitch, if you were the sports director at Ineos or Jumbo-Visma, what would you be saying? Because it's La Planche des Belles Filles tomorrow, and somehow the challengers have got to pick themselves up and make sure that they don't concede too much more ground to Pogacar.
Well, I think Ineos is in a great position, and they're sticking to what we initially said, is that they're going to be taking a more aggressive attacking role. They're not lining up with their whole team, with their one GC guy. I predict that these guys now, the four guys they got in the GC, are going to be able to really play their cards. And this is the only way I think that Pogacar is going to be put under pressure. UAE can't control everyone. There's going to come a point where the team is going to be exposed. We even saw it to an extent today. They were very impressive up the last climb. But once they have to take that on, you know, like that move today from Wout van Aert, that put a lot of teams under stress today. One guy. You know, he is probably, you know, a very special guy. But I think that's the way things have got to continue to go. If we're going to see something shaken up, you know, I don't know. I know teams aren't going to lay down and go, it's all over. That's for sure not. But we need to see this aggressive racing from Ineos that they've promised, that they said they want to do. Now it's time to do that tomorrow. Shake it up. Try some new things.
And Francois, what we do know is that the cumulative effect of the Tour de France is often what catches riders out. They had a very hard day on the cobbles yesterday, really fast average speed. I mean, you can talk about tailwind all you like, but they've still got to ride at that pace and that intensity. Same again today, incredibly fast stage. They were so far up on schedule, it was crazy. And then tomorrow, the rhythm changes completely, doesn't it? Because, you know, it's kind of a flat run into La Planche des Belles Filles. Not only La Planche des Belles Filles, but also the gravel and the super planche. So a really difficult finish tomorrow. And everyone is going to be put under pressure, we assume, by Pogacar. But there are opportunities.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Ineos, of course. I mean, that's really impressive. I mean, you know, four guys in the top eight is, you know, with a week, nearly a week completed, and you know, before the serious business starts. I wouldn't rule out Jumbo-Visma. They had a bad day yesterday, but in the end, a relatively bad day. I think, in a way, it kind of solved their problems of leadership yesterday, and we saw again today Jonas Vingegaard looks very strong, actually, yet without this puncture he will still be very close to the top. And I mean, I asked Frans Masson this morning, I said, you did have your bad day, so what's, you know, what next? I mean, every team has their bad day, you've had it, so maybe, you know, that's it, it's done, you know. And I found that now, I mean, the leadership problem is probably solved. I mean, we know that Primoz Roglic is way back. He had this dislocated shoulder. We don't exactly know what the impact will be. But we saw today that he was the first to attack on the last climb. So, I mean, this aggressive riding, this kind of, you know, skirmishes coming from all, you know, all angles can also be one of the strategies for and one of the tactics for Jumbo-Visma. So Pogacar hasn't yet, you know, solved the problems of, you know, the harassing from the other teams. Yet, you know, the way today they were supposed to be chasing behind the break because, you know, Wout van Aert was there. You couldn't really say they were affected by the breakaway when you have two guys to lead out, you know, their leaders on the final stretch like they did today. UAE looks strong as well. So, I mean, you know, still very exciting. Of course, Pogacar has, you know, made his point clear. We knew that this would happen, but nobody's really lost. And once again, after a week, I still, the strengths are Ineos. Who will be the team leader? We still don't know. Adam Yates looks good. Danny Martinez never loses it. Geraint Thomas is there in the mix as well. So, you know, exciting top Pidcock today. I've got one of those silly statistics about Tom Pidcock. He's now the third youngest British rider to finish in the top three of a Tour de France stage.
Tenuous that, Francois.
You'll never find out who. Well, we'll ask our listeners who is the youngest
British rider to finish top three in a Tour stage.
I'm imagining
then that it's a bit of a left field answer. Is it Michael Wright?
It's a long time ago, and I, to be honest, didn't know that. You know, it's a kind of stats you get.
Do you know the answer?
I know the answer.
Well, tell us the answer.
It was 1967, and the rider was Peter Hale.
Ah, okay, well. interesting. We're talking about Ben O'Connor and how his morale might have taken a dent after the ordeal on the cobbles. Really, I mean, he got through it. He'd lost some time. You know, that was recoverable, I guess. But today he had another difficult day. And Mitch, you spoke to him at the finish, and as we'll hear, having a difficult few days on the Tour de France.
Ben, how was that, mate? I'll let you keep rolling because that was ridiculously hard.
Yeah, that was one of the toughest stages, that's for sure.
Off the back of yesterday as well?
Yeah, I'm not really sure what to say. Oh, I could cry. I'm really disappointed today.
How are you feeling now with the pace of the peloton now? Have you felt like today, off the back of the last few days, it just feels like things are ridiculous out there?
I mean, we had a rocking tailwind today, so it looks super rapid, but that's the reason why I'm just still suffering from this crash myself. You know, it's not like anything changed out there from Dauphiné to Catalunya. This is how I've been racing all year. And you can probably tell yourself it's also been like that the last couple of years. So, don't know what to say.
Get in the bus, mate. Recover.
Well, when you think back to last year's Tour and how well Ben O'Connor did, I mean, he was the star of the show, wasn't he, when the race first hit the mountains? He's had a difficult couple of days here. And, well, my heart kind of broke for him a bit there because he sounds like he needs picking up by his team management or something, just to get him through the next few days and see whether he can come round for the second half of the Tour.
Well, he's a guy that, you know, thrives on the confidence, and we saw that with his statement, you know, before he went into Dauphiné. I want to finish top three on a World Tour stage, and he went there and did it. Not a lot of riders will put that out there. They won't put themselves in that vulnerable position, but clearly that is something that he really likes. So on the flip side, when he's not feeling the confidence, I don't know how that's going to be. It was quite a crushing conversation with him today after the race. I really did feel for him because I know he holds that level, that idea of himself, that where he wants to go. So, you know, he's got his goals. He'll reset. I just hope the damage hasn't been done and his head doesn't roll off, per se. I don't think it will. I think he's stronger than that. He hasn't got to that position, you know, and just sort of keel over and die, you know, just because he hasn't had a good day. I think I caught him at that moment at the end of the race where all that emotion was in his head. But I know that he'll come back strong. And actually, in my opinion, it makes him very dangerous. Slightly off GC. There's going to be enough people to watch. And we've already seen it when he's been slightly off GC, he can get himself back in. He's a rider of that quality, and suddenly now he's super dangerous. Someone they can't control. They can't afford to control everyone sitting at 2 minutes down or wherever he's sitting. They're going to have to let someone go. He could be that guy that gets up the road and gets himself straight back into it.
Yeah, this said, if you look at the results today, I mean, you know, you have guys that after a week of racing have managed to you know, finish unscathed. I'm thinking of Nairo Quintana, we mentioned him. If you look at the results, David Godu was third today on a terrain that suits him, but it's, you know, tomorrow is a very important stage for Groupama FDJ because we're in Thibaut Pinot's homeland. So for them, you know, it's one of the stages to watch. Romain Bardet as well, you know, has been there always. You know, talked to him at the finish, and well, it was more, you know, expressing his admiration for Wout van Aert than talking about his own chances. But you know, you can tell by his kind of discretion and kind of, you know, confidence that is there. We were talking about Ben O'Connor, to stay with Australians. I also talked to Matt White at the finish, and Michael Matthews finished second like he did, you know, behind Peter Sagan. And Matt White was really frustrated because he said, Michael is too nice, you know. In the finale, he'd done the right thing. He was in Pogacar's wheel. He could have used his slipstream when Pogacar attacked to overtake him, but only a few riders were in the way. Tish Benoot, you know, a couple of Colombians, and that's probably a problem. I mean, you know, Bling, as they call him, better than I do. But really, with a little bit more will. Power, a little bit more aggressiveness. Do you think he could have challenged?
I mean, he could have had boxing gloves on and he'd still have finished second to Pogacar today. I mean, yeah, I get what you're saying, and it's frustrating to be in a great position, but when Pogacar turned on the afterburners, there was only going to be one winner as far as I could see, really.
It looked that way, yes. But I do agree with Francois that it is, if there is a downfall, you know, there is one downfall of Michael, but is that a downfall? You're a nice guy. You know, you want to be known as, you know, a real rough guy with all these stage wins and all these wins. That's that hard decision you've got to make as an athlete.
That's a philosophical question, isn't it? You know, nice guy with loads of wins or...
No, nice guy with no wins versus...
Nasty guy with loads of wins.
A nasty word with lots of wins.
Now, Francois, you've ordered another Orval. Thank you very much. In a way, you fulfilled an ambition that's been burning for the best part of a week, because Francois, you were telling Mitch about this secret van that travels around with the Tour de France.
Yeah, it's called Le Cul du Camion. I mean, so our French listeners will know what I mean. It means the backside of the track, if you want, the rear of the van. And it's actually, ASO, I've got a little van going through all around France, and they've got this the same van on all their races, and it's a nondescript van, you know. There's nothing special to it. Only it's parked, you know, not too far away from the press center every day, and the permanence, which is the place where all the big shots of ASO stay. At the back of the van, you know, they open up the doors and you spread a little bit of a few chairs there. And have you know, and drink Ricard from a plastic cups. You know, it's pretty strange, but they do that almost every race. It lasts like nearly an hour of, you know, debriefing the race, drinking a few beers, and it's become kind of a legend. You know, to be invited at the Cul du Camion at the rear of the van, you must be really, you know, an insider of the race.
Well, we felt like gate crashers a bit, didn't we, Mitch? Thierry Gouvenou was there, of course, the course director. Seb Piquet turned up in red car number one, the voice of Race Radio, of course, and a very good friend of the cycling podcast. We were kind of on the edge of the group. You were chatting away, Mitch, to some people that you knew, but we weren't invited to join them for a drink, were we? It's very much an ASO insider thing, I get the feeling.
I felt like I was, would have been, I just, there was something, yeah, I felt on my own, I probably had a better chance, but yeah, with my two... Yeah.
But with us two losers, there was no way we were going to get invited.
I've been invited to the Cul du Camion more than once, but I didn't want, you know, to intrude too much. But no, Edwin insisted just a little bit, they would have offered Ricard. But did you guys really want... you know, warm no. Ricard at the back of the van?
Not really.
I don't know if we're supposed to be talking about it. I think it was
a
bit of
a secret.
You know, yeah, it's
well, just listeners, just ignore the last couple of minutes of the podcast. Mitch, you were saying you were slightly underwhelmed. You were expecting it to be a bit more, I don't know, pimped up. You could probably lay on a much better van, a lot more choice, maybe get some beers on ice.
It was presented to me like there was mini fridges there, and you know, there's going to be, you know, laid out sort of, you know, appetizers and a bit of cheese with a cheese board, that sort of feel.
But if it's too showy and too, you know, and
people
and,
know,
yeah, people would know what it is. Like here, you see a group of people, you know, you have the impression they discussed the race or some, you know, some technical issue, and you have no idea that actually Thierry Gouvenou, you know, who's the sports director of the Tour de France, you and Sepp Piquet, I mean, all these guys, and Jean, you know, Jean-Michel Monin, who's a rider you've known forever, who's in charge of the paddock. You think they're discussing the organization of the race. They're not at all. They're just having a drink.
They're just having a post-race drink, and why not? Before we discuss the issue of what on earth Wout van Aert was doing today, let's also give a shout out to Total Energies, because we stopped at a service station today and they wanted 80 cents to visit the toilet. I was stunned that all the staff behind the counter were wearing kind of t-shirts that look like the Total Energies jersey.
Is that help funding the team?
Yeah.
I hope
80 cents, you know, it's €2.40. It's probably paying for a cap that, you know, for Peter Sagan.
I think it's going directly into Sagan's pocket, that money. You know, literally taking the pee there with the charge at the service station. Anyway, Wout van Aert, I mean, we were stunned when we heard that he was up the road in the break, riding very strongly. I mean, they weren't hanging about, were they? When we saw the three of them together, Quinn Simmons and Jakob Fuglsang, I mean, three class quality riders. Perfect for this sort of terrain. I mean, Fuglsang is a veteran of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and of course, he's won the race, and we're not a million miles away from that sort of countryside. Quinn Simmons is obviously a talent. Wout van Aert is one of the best riders in the world on almost all terrain, and we wondered what on earth they were doing, especially when the gap got up to 4 minutes. Francois, you spoke to Frans Madsen, one of the sports directors at Jumbo-Visma, at the finish.
So he confirmed one of the theories we had, because I mean, obviously we discussed the point, you know, in the car, and one of the suggestions was that by putting someone in front, Jumbo-Visma were not doing the chasing job. It was up to the other teams to work in the in the peloton, to work at the front of the bunch, to chase behind the breakaway, and so Jumbo-Visma had a reasonably easy day. That's the option Madsen decided to, you know, defend at the end of the stage. To me, it looks a little bit like, you know, in some rugby or football matches, you know, when the script goes a little bit off bonds, that there's always a logical explanation that comes afterwards. So I'm not really sure it's valid, but it's a fair point. My personal take on it, and I've seen on the social network that there's been questions about Wout van Aert's team spirit, you know, when he should maybe have stayed with the leaders, is also that I'm sure van Aert, after his, you know, very exciting win in Calais, was very frustrated by yesterday's stage when, you know, he had his problem crashed and had to work for his leaders, and it was probably his last opportunity to shine before the mountains, and maybe we'll see more of van Aert at the end of the Tour de France in Rocamadour or in Paris. But you know, he's up for 2 weeks of domestic job, so it was his last day in the limelight. So.
Mm. What do you think, Mitch? I mean, what's your take on it?
Yeah, the only thing I could sort of see with that was that it was Belgium. You know, the one stage that went through Belgium, and I was there at the start today when we're at the buses, and as he rolled past, it was almost like a Mexican wave of just noise as he rolled with the crowd. Wah! You know, going past.
Wow. It was almost like Francois and his check, wasn't it?
Yeah. But, you know. It was a bit louder.
It was loud, yeah.
Check. It was... and... You know, I think from what I understand with Fuglsang, Israel Premiertech really wanted one in that move today. And I think because it was so aggressive at the start, it took over 50K before it went. Everyone was down to the resources, and Fuglsang was simply covering a move, ended up in there by chance, just so they had one there. Good GC guys were moving, the yellow jersey, so he jumped on it. Then when he was in there, from what I understand, the direction was, well, stay there. If this goes to 5 minutes, this is a good chance. When it didn't get to 5 minutes, he pulled over, had himself a little pee, went back to the peloton. The thing that showed me how impressive Wout van Aert was, again, was that Quinn Simmons was actually ridden out of the wheel.
Yeah.
And we've all had that moment when you're just riding on, you know, it was a slight uphill, it wasn't crazy. Wout did not attack, really. Just got out of the seat, and Quinn Simmons, and he is a very strong rider. I've ridden with him the last couple of years. He got ridden out of the wheel, and he was suffering up there. And he just, and then Wout just went on. And the thing that impressed me so much was just the teams having to just use guys up, burn guys to get him back. It was getting to dangerous situations. Of course, they got him back 10K to go. But, I mean, it was a hard day out there. The feeling I got from all the riders I spoke to at the end, the ones I recorded, the ones I didn't record, was just, what is going on? This was just ridiculous. This was so hard. A day I certainly would not have loved.
Well, maybe that's the strategy, isn't it? Because the more attritional, the harder, the more unpredictable it is, the more chance there is that something incredible and unpredictable might happen further down the line. We'll have to wait and see. Francois, you spoke to Romain Bardet today about Van Aert, and it's really interesting to hear his perspective as a rider, because, you know, there's all these kind of discussions about, you know, what the yellow jersey should and shouldn't do in the Tour de France. And, you know, we don't often see the yellow jersey off the front, up the road, in a break like that. Obviously, in the mountains, when the yellow jersey is racing for the overall win, we see attacks all the time. But on these kind of stages, we don't see this kind of racing. So it was really interesting to hear Romain Bardet's perspective. And I'm not saying he speaks for the peloton, but he certainly gives an interesting point of view.
He's an immense champion, and he almost made it. Honestly, everyone was super impressed with what he did. I think he's honoring the race with his action, and we can only just salute him, because he's making cycling beautiful.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. I mean, we are recording literally in our feed zone, aren't we? We're at our restaurant table. We're looking at the menu. We're going to fuel for the night, make sure we're fit, ready for tomorrow's podcast. Big day ahead of us. If you're riding, any kind of riding or racing, going on a sportive type event, or just bike packing, it's always a good idea to fuel properly. And Science in Sport have all of the products you need for before, during and after your ride. Can particularly recommend the Beta Fuel, because when I was riding around Scotland, that was basically my fuel. I was just supplementing all the normal food I was eating, topping up little and often with the Beta Fuel throughout the day, and I didn't feel like I was overloading and making my stomach work too hard, because the Beta Fuel drinks are just giving you a lot of carbohydrate in a very efficient manner. You can get 25% off all Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Francois, Mitch, we need to look back a little bit at yesterday, because although we were out there on the cobbles, I mean, we got closer than almost anyone, really, didn't we, Mitch? And Francois, you had eyes on the race. As I said in the podcast yesterday, the stories come out in the wash overnight, don't they? And one of the things that everyone latched onto was, what was Alberto Bettiol of EF doing? Because he was at one point on the front. There were accusations and suggestions, including from one of the GCN pundits, Robbie McEwen, that perhaps Bettiol was doing a bit too much to assist Tadej Pogacar while he had two teammates up the road. Jonathan Vaught has tweeted to say that the debrief would be interesting. And, well, there was a bit of a media scrum around the EF Education Easy Post team boss this morning at the start. And this is what Jonathan Vaught has said.
It was interesting. I mean, end of the day, like, I'm not going to disclose what we talk about in a debrief, because that's why it's a private debrief. But end of the day, it took longer than a normal debrief would. And at the end of it, we came to a good conclusion, and we came out of it in a good place as a unified team. So it took a while to get there, but we got there. Very bluntly speaking, that, you know, Alberto, you know, he won the most prestigious one-day race in the world a few years ago. And he's had to deal with some incredibly difficult health issues since then. Some health issues that for a lot of people would have ended their career. he hasn't been like really at the front of a race for a while, and he hasn't had really good legs for a long time. He just got into a situation where he was just overly excited and kind of forgot himself a little bit. He owns that. You know, he apologized to his teammates and just said, I got too excited. It's really that simple. There's not as many conspiracy theories as you evil journalists like to make.
Vought is playing it down there. I also think that a bit of a mountain has been made out of a molehill, or an all-category controversy has been made out of a fourth-category rumpus. Because Bettiol was racing. He's a Tour of Flanders champion in the past. The cobbles are his territory. He's had a rough time over the past couple of years. Feeling good, going for it. The optics obviously weren't great because, you know, he may have cost Neil St. Paulus something. But I spoke to Tom Southern, one of the sports directors, and as you said, Francois, yesterday, Charlie Wagelius was the person who came up with this plan to try and get either Paulus or Uran or both of them up the road with a teammate to gain time. And Southern confirmed that the objective of the day was to get Paulus ahead of everybody for the cobbles so that he was following fewer wheels, he had a clear line, he would be out of the chaos and mayhem, less likely to crash or have problems or lose wheels and lose time. And so they were really happy with how the stage panned out. It's just that as it got towards the end, the tantalising prospect of a stage win and the yellow jersey were both within reach. And of course, neither panned out. And so the overriding kind of impression was, oh, well, they must be disappointed. But he claimed that they weren't disappointed. And so, you know, this suggestion that Bettiol was riding against team orders, I don't know what you think, Mitch, but I just thought maybe a little bit overblown.
I 100% agree with the plan. I never thought of such an idea myself. I think it was a great idea because I've ridden off the front of Roubaix a couple of times, and I can tell you firsthand, riding in a breakaway on Roubaix is a completely different race than riding in the peloton. And that is the best idea for the GC guys. I never really thought of it, and I thought, oh, wow, that's an amazing idea. Then I thought about the stage and obviously the yellow jersey. It was a really good plan from EF. And actually, even though they didn't come away with the stage and even though they didn't come away with the yellow jersey, I still think it was really successful because I think the yellow jersey may have been a hindrance. You know, I felt a bit sad for Nielsen today because that was a real chance for him to get the yellow jersey. That would have been a nice little tip of the cap, you know. Yesterday, to get the yellow jersey, they would have had to ride control today, a very hard day to control, and they potentially would have put a lot of riders in the red. So it can be a blessing in disguise. And about Alberto, I don't believe that. I know him personally, and I don't believe that he has that sort of motive, or he is very, very respectful. And I just don't think he would go about it like that way. So why was he at the front? Why was he talking today, Pogacar, about who knows what? And it looked like he was working together. I don't know. I think there is something about just getting caught up in the moment. You can't underestimate how hectic it is at Roubaix. You don't know what's going on. And people are like, oh, how could he not know what's going on? He may have thought Rigo was in the wheels. They weren't thinking about trying to take the yellow jersey, as you said. So no one was thinking, oh, don't chase Nielsen down because he's going to get the yellow. That was just the outcome at the end of the day. So I think it's just a situation. I don't believe that it was his first chance to feel good and he's, you know, that story that has been spun because he was going very well at Tour of Suisse. I just think it was the moment. He got caught up in the race. He was trying to do his job, trying to ride hard, close the gap, not thinking of the consequences.
Francois, you had a better excuse for EF when it came to explaining what Bettiol was doing, didn't you? You had a ready-made. You could go into PR.
I think, you know, Well, one of the things is it's better. It's always better for a rider, you know, to ride up the front on the cobbles anyway, than to be at the back. So you're Alberto Bettiol. You're in a group like this. You have two of your teammates in front. So one, it's better to pick your cobbles, to pick your way, to be in the front than at the back in the bunch with the dust and everything. Secondly. We all know that happens, you know, and that's what I would have had I been a PR man. Sometimes when you go up to the front of the chase, it's just to slow down the chase, you know, and it's something that we should have a look at, you know, did actually the Pogacar group take back that much on the breakaway. No, they didn't, you know. Mm. And then Betterol only like took turns with Pogacar for like 10Ks, yeah, and two sectors. So I think it was, as you said, it was really totally beefed up, you know, this controversy. My impression is I love my colleagues, and I've been I'm a journalist, and we like good stories and we like good controversies, obviously. But let's face it, we had the first week of the tour. It was announced, like, you know, everybody was, oh, beware of Denmark echelons. Ooh, beware of the bridge. You know, it'll be hell. And then, ooh, the wait for the cobbles is going to be, you know. And in the end, compared to last year when no cobbles, no bridge, no echelons, well, actually not no real echelons, we're in Brittany, you had crashes, you know, mm-hmm. and in big pileups every day. So the controversy were there, oh, you know, safety. And it's funny because every day in the first week when I talked to team directors before the stage, I said, oh, yeah, well, you know, the course, I mean, ASO, Thierry Gouvenou, they're really trying to make sure there's going to be crash. And none of that happened. So when you don't have that kind of news stories, well, you make them up.
Yeah. Or create them. But Mitch, you've got a real world example of actually slowing down a break by riding on the front.
I totally agree with Francois that, you know, I've been in that situation myself. I was at the Commonwealth Games in the Gold Coast at the last Commonwealth Games, and I found myself in the break, and it wasn't an ideal situation for us. And Brad McGee, our director sportif, came up to me. We had the Australia riding behind for Steele Van Hoff, who won the event in the end. He came up and he's like, what are you rolling through for? Why are you still working with these guys? We're chasing behind. And I said, Brad, are we extending the time? Like, no, we're not. I said, well, because I'm actually rolling through here and I'm slowing it down. Every time I go to the front, I take it off 1 or 2K an hour. And then the guy behind me, he rolls through at the same speed. By the time it gets back around again, they try and get the speed up again. We've actually lost 5-6 seconds to the peloton. If I just sit on the back and just stay out of the way, the group's going to work really well together and actually extend it and be a harder chase for Australia. In the Commonwealth Games, we've only got 5 riders. So I thought it's better for me to roll through, use my experience, my influence, and actually try and intimidate these guys. This is a speed we need to ride, believe me. And actually, I was slowing it right down.
Well, the controversy really was kind of, you know, washed away by the events of today's stage, wasn't it? The suggestion that Betiol has got a move lined up to UAE Team Emirates, that's why the mark he's contracted to EF. But I have got a conspiracy theory of my own, which is an absolute... I'm just flying this one, but maybe it was a storyline created for the Netflix documentary. Of course, Netflix are here. They want stories. You know, Jonathan Vaughters is, sometimes thinks his way, you know, into a cul-de-sac and back out again and then round the corner. Maybe they were kind of, you know, planting a little storyline to get themselves a prominent slot on the Netflix documentary. I mean, that's just a silly suggestion, but, you know, the tour thrives on these stories, doesn't it?
Talking about Netflix, I heard that they were looking for a male voice with a slight French accent to do voiceovers.
Well,
on their, you are know, you going to do series. It? I've been indirectly approached. So I mean, you know, Netflix people, if you're listening to the podcast,
you're very reasonable.
Yeah, why not? You know, just give me a ring.
Two Orvals, and he's yours, Netflix. Let's wrap up yesterday, because Mitch, at the start this morning, you spoke to the two of the riders in that break, Taco van der Hoorn, who nearly won, and Simon Clark from Australia, who did win. So let's hear what Taco van der Hoorn and Simon Clark said.
Well, Taco, so not so much luck with the breakaway so far. I thought I would have seen you feature at least in about 4 breaks already, but what's been going on?
No. I'm a bit done with only going in the break for no results. I only choose the days where I think there's a chance, and I wanted to save my legs for yesterday, so I didn't want to waste any energy in the first days.
And yesterday, an amazing ride by you. Very, very hard to call at the end, even to a photo finish. What was your idea coming into the finish there? Obviously, you have a plan. That's something you and I talked about before. Was it exactly how it worked out for you? Obviously, not for the final bit, but in your mind, that was how you wanted to play it?
I knew where there was already from the start, where there was a small narrowing, where I think there was a good chance to go. So I went there full gas, and then we rode away. So there was already according plan. And then we had a good group, and we I was also the plan to keep riding high speed all day and don't do easy and then speed up, because there you need as much as time before the first section. So we did really good in that. I think we were riding 50k for the first 2 hours. It was pretty fast. And then in the final, it was nice that EF killed himself a bit with having two guys and then only one guy in the front. So that was making it easier. And I wanted to do a tech maybe in the last k, but then Nielsen went. And then it was not on me to counter, because I'm not the fastest guy, so I just gambled. And then I was in perfect position, but yeah, in the end I just not make it.
It was an incredible effort. I'm not going to downplay that, but you know how it goes. You especially know how it goes. Are you still happy with that result, all things considered? You know, was the team still happy with it? Because it was an amazing ride.
Quite a disappointment, yeah. If you're so close to a tour stage, then you want to win. And the team was happy, and they also did everything you could, but yeah.
Simon, mate, you must be feeling over the moon, you know, a Tour de France stage, but just where you've come from, like, we were speaking together, you know, in the off-season, like, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen this year. You kicked off the season so well, already like to be proud of that, but this is like icing on the cake for your whole career, but also from this season.
You couldn't ride it better, could you? Just so happy. I just try and always look forward, you know, stay positive. And everyone has tough times, whether it's injuries or illness, or, you know, I've had bad luck recently with a few teams folding and whatnot. And you just got to stay positive and keep moving forward. And, you know, that's what I'm doing, and it seems to be working. So
run me through the final bit. I just spoke to Taco actually, and I said, you know, you still got to be happy with that ride. But he wasn't. He was very disappointed because he gambled. But I feel like you even gambled more than he gambled. And it's a serious poker game out there, wasn't it? Run me through the final, what you were thinking, especially when Nielsen went off the front.
As you know, I've been in those situations quite a few times before in the Vuelta when I've won. And you have to gamble. You have to be cold and you have to be willing to lose. Palace went and I went to go. You'll see on the video, I went to go after him. And then I suddenly thought, no, it's not up to me. This is up to the other two who are on paper the better sprinters than I am. So I sat back and I said, no, I'll leave this up to them. And then when they weren't going, I was starting to get a little bit worried. And I thought, I'll just leave Edvold a few bike lengths in the corner. And maybe if he looks back, that'll be enough bait for him to try and get the jump on me. And that worked perfectly. And he went, and then I went after him, and he basically towed us back in and brought us back into the game. And then I know Taco likes a long sprint. We saw him win that race a month or so ago. And he just hits out at 400 and rides the guys off the wheel. And he has an amazing sprint, but a long one. And so then when he went and I looked up and saw the 350 to go board, I was like, wow, we've been sprinting for 800 meters here already. If he can do this all the way to the line, this is going to be impressive. So I just tried to get on the wheel. Wait, leave it as absolute late as possible. And every time I got out of the seat, I was cramping. You see me get out of the seat and then back in, and I was cramping in both legs. And then, like 50 meters to go, I just went for the line. And to be honest, I didn't think I got it. I was still like half a bike length behind him when we started hitting the Skoda signage there. And I just said, I'm going to need the best throw I've ever thrown to get this, and just lined up the biggest lunge I could, and yeah, I can't believe it.
Well, we need to order our dinner, but before we go, a quick edition of the Michelin Guide, because we had a very nice hotel last night, Le Grand Duc in Valenciennes. We had a really nice meal and a couple of very nice local beers, as people who listened last night will have known. But Mitch, from the hotel point of view, what was your rating?
I really liked it. I'm not going to give it 5. I can't, because the internet wasn't working. I know it's a silly thing, but the aesthetics of the place was amazing. It was one of those places, Francois, was it like an old, what sort of building was it?
I think it's probably what we'll call a maison bourgeoise, you know? It's a kind of mansion, you know, townhouse, you know, used by the people in Valenciennes. Valenciennes was a textile town, so there were probably, you know, some guys making a little bit of money out of this in the late 19th century. And this is the kind of house. It looks, you know, it looks a little bit nondescript from the outside. And then when you get inside, you know, because these guys at the time, they didn't want to show off. So, you know, the wealth was hidden, and there was a cage there.
That's what I was about to say, is that once you got outside the backyard, it just kept going. Mm. You know, it was an amazing garden in the backyard. But what made it for me was the hotel owner. He was fantastic, a really good service, came out. And one thing I found quite funny, I don't know, actually afterwards I thought it was quite creepy, but it was quite entertaining at the time, was what we were talking about, suddenly the music would play. So for instance, we'd be talking about, oh, I think it's going to rain tomorrow. Yeah, rain. And then all of a sudden it'd be...
Raindrops are falling on my head.
Raindrops are falling on my head. It would start playing, you know, and...
The music matched the conversation,
didn't it?
It
really did, which afterwards when I thought about it, I was like, oh, that's a bit weird because he was listening to our conversation. But it was quite nice at the time. The wines were very good. The dinner was phenomenal. And the rooms were great too. A really nice big bathroom. So look, the Michelin guide, 4.5.
4.5, half stars, excellent. I mean, Mitch, I do have to point out that if, you know, our business model does depend on people listening to what we say. So, you know, I'm quite okay with that. Coincidentally, Richard Moore and I and our agent David Luxton and friend of the podcast and photographer extraordinaire Simon Gill, we all stayed there in that hotel for Paris-Roubaix last year, which was of course your last pro race. A weekend I remember very fondly, and so I was weirdly I was in exactly the same room as I was on that trip with Richard. And so, as people will know, we've been finishing our episodes with an episode of the Tour de Buffalo, and this takes us back because tomorrow the race goes to La Planche des Belles Filles. And Francois, you'll remember this. Do you remember the water challenge?
You
told us in the car that you could define the different bottled waters, you know, Volvic, Evian, some of the other brands, you could tell them apart just on a blind test. And we did not believe you. And so we went to a shop and we bought these different waters. And well, this is what happened.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
So my brother actually messaged me to say that I should have told his stoat joke in the episode.
Which is?
What's the difference between a stoat and a weasel?
I don't know.
One's weaselly identified, the other's totally different.
Oh, very good. I mean, the tumbleweed will be blowing through in a minute.
What's the difference between a good joke and a bad joke? Timing.
Oh, this is nonsense. It's been the first big stage of the Tour de France, and we're, you know, we're but let's go from the sublime to the ridiculous. This does at least have a Tour de France theme to it. We finished in Vittel yesterday. The stage start was in Vittel this morning, of course, famous for its mineral water. But last night we were staying just down the road, around 5 kilometres away, at Contrexéville, which is famous for its water also. And I asked Francois whether there had ever been a big rivalry between the water producers, and apparently in the past there would have been, because these two communities with their water trying to dominate the water market. They're both now owned by Nestle, Vittel and Contrex water. So, but you were saying this morning in the car that you reckoned you could pick out Contrex in a lineup.
Yeah, Contrex is kind of different from the others. Normally, I have four glasses of water in front of me. I suppose one is Evian, one is Vittel, the other one is Volvic, and another one is Contrex. And the mission I've been offered is to determine, well, if I can, you know, the grand slam would be to detect.
Get them all, but yeah. you've got to try and pick out the Contrex.
Completely blind. But here.
This is the first ever edition of the Cycling Podcast water feature.
I'm photographing
that was Rich's suggestion for a title.
The water feature. Feature.
If it goes well, this could be a daily thing, guys. Come on.
Hopefully in Nuit Saint-Georges we'll taste wine, but we'll see.
Okay.
Good radio? I'm not sure. Sure.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out later, won't we? So, glass number one, please. We're going to have to hurry you along here, Francois. You haven't got time to swill it round or sniff it. You've just got to taste. Take a big gulp there of glass number one. Is that Contrex? No, shaking his head. Okay, glass number two. God, he's doing this with the verve of a seasoned wine taster.
Mm, okay.
Glass number three.
That's Contrex.
Oh, he's gone straight for it. And glass number four.
Right, that's Vittel. Evian, Volvic, Contrex,
Absolutely.
That's 100%. Extraordinary. 100%. I was so looking forward to that being wrong.
We must promise everybody here I didn't cheat.
No, that was absolutely 100%. It's a mere sip of each one. We even gave you a little bit of beer beforehand to ruin your palate.
Yeah, well, no, it's just, you know, just to water my mouth a little bit. Beer was necessary. Well, maybe there's a profession ahead of me.
Water tasting.
That's amazing.
We'll catch up tomorrow and discuss the first big mountain of the tour. Mitch, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Francois, your water tasting skills are unsurpassed. Thank you.
We'll do it again when you want. Merci.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.